Speaker, State Secretary for Aid of Persecuted Christians for the Hungary Helps Program in the Prime Minister's Office from the Government of Hungary, Tristan Azbez. We cannot thank you and the Hungarian government enough for the incredible commitment and the work that you, your team, and really the Hungarian people are doing to serve the persecuted Christians all around the world. We're honored to be with you here today, and I'm more than pleased to give you the floor, sir. So please.
Thank you, Excellencies, the ladies and gentlemen. I welcome you at our event of the Hungary Helps Program together with the International Christian Concern. The ICC is an organization with which we are very proud to partner up, along with all of you who are champions of religious freedom and are defenders of the persecuted Christians throughout the world. I know a lot, if not all of us, face hard times because of the pandemic situation. But even these dire days, we must not forget those for whom the coronavirus seems to be a lesser evil. The lesser evil comparing the existential threats they face every single day because of religious persecution. The number of Christians experiencing religious persecution in the world rose from 245 million to 260 million in the course of only 1 year. Last year, nearly 3,000 Christians were murdered as a direct result of their faith and persecution. More than 9,500 places of worship were attacked, and over 3,700 Christians were imprisoned or detained. And of course, these are always only the registered cases, the cases what we know of, the cases that are the tip of the iceberg. As the Bishop of Touro's report has found, one third of the world's population suffers from religious persecution in some form, with Christians being the most persecuted group by numbers. Ladies and gentlemen, the number of persecuted Christians is increasing, and their cries for help cannot go unheard any longer. Today, we focus on the plight of Christians in West Africa. The situation of these Christian communities is deteriorating rapidly. Multiple reports confirmed that there is a genocide occurring in Burkina Faso and the northern part of Nigeria and in other regions. Terrorist groups, principally Boko Haram, the Fulani tribes, militias, and ISWAP, as well as other armed groups and bandits have killed close to 7,000 people this year alone. Over the past years, Boko Haram alone murdered more people than Daesh in Iraq and Syria combined. And the situation is only getting worse. As of December 2019, there were over 2.2 million IDPs in the country of Nigeria. The situation created by the targeted and deliberate killing of Christians by terrorist groups is aggravated by other factors, such as the global pandemic, floods, food shortages, which combined have created an immensely complex humanitarian crisis in the country associated with religious persecution. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, Hungary, the Hungarian government and the Hungarian people believe that beyond advocacy and diplomacy, it is essential to act in solidarity with beleaguered communities and extend a helping hand. The Hungarian humanitarian model is guided by the principle that help must be provided where the need arises, instead of encouraging the suffering communities to forfeit their homelands and migrate. We believe in providing humanitarian aid to beleaguered communities directly, in situ, and where appropriate, working through local churches and faith-based organizations to ensure meaningful and efficient response to local needs. As the case of Nigeria illustrates, humanitarian aid and the freedom of religion and belief are inseparable. As the persecution of religious communities, especially Christians, is one of the most pressing humanitarian crises in the world, providing aid to these communities and going beyond advocacy and diplomacy is essential. Based on the Hungarian model, we have already implemented more than 7 humanitarian projects in Nigeria, providing valuable lessons for our future work. I would like to discuss three or four projects in a little bit more detail, just to give you an example and share these examples and experiences we have. Firstly, the aid provided through the Hungary Helps program to the Roman Catholic Diocese of Maiduguri, which is the birthplace of Boko Haram, by the way, contributes to the reconstruction of a destroyed seminary, the opening of a secondary school, the establishment of a college of education, as well as the post-genocide or sim-genocide reconstruction of the Bishop Timothy Kotter Memorial Hospital. Overall, the project allows the diocese to continue providing essential education and other services to the Christians and the other communities living along with the Christians, despite the onslaught by Boko Haram. The project is progressing steadfast. We have already opened a school there, and the construction works have begun at the other locations as well. Secondly, the aid provided to the Roman Catholic Diocese of Sokoto, we welcome His Excellency Bishop Kuka to the discussion. This aid focused on the development of the educational infrastructure. The aid covers the construction of schools and colleges in Ilala, Mount Fashi, and Gusau settlements. Despite some serious difficulties posed by the current pandemic, construction works have begun on the new buildings, and we hope that they will open their doors in the near future. Finally, the third project I would like to talk about is implemented by a Protestant church, the Church of Christ in Nations in the Middle Belt region of Nigeria. And it has served the return of Christian refugees to their homes ravaged by Boko Haram, as well as supporting agriculture activities that ensure the self-sufficiency of these households. This is basically a rehabilitation aid program to a rural agricultural area. And so far, the project has had a reach of approximately 2,000 households, thanks to our local church partners. Besides these three projects, the Hungarian government, through the Hungary Helps program, also provided emergency aid, humanitarian fast relief, rehabilitation aid to various communities all around the country, with the common feature of that we work together with local faith-based organizations that we can trust. So what are the takeaway lessons that I offer for your consideration from our programs? There are a number of key lessons learned from the projects that the Hungarian government has supported over the last 3 years, not just in Nigeria, but throughout the region as well. First of all, as I have already pointed out, freedom of religion and belief and humanitarian aid cannot and must not be separated. There are many organizations of goodwill who just couldn't make the link that religious persecution creates a humanitarian need that needs a specific way to address. It cannot just be addressed through the comprehensive, overarching humanitarian aid programs. It has to be very targeted. So the next lesson that I would like to offer is also linked to the first one, and it concerns the beneficiaries of aid projects. Our experience, what we have found on the ground, support the main pillars of the Hungarian model and have shown that local faith-based organizations and churches are the best at not only assessing the most immediate needs of the communities, but also in implementing these projects. So I strongly encourage other programs to include these organizations as implementers of their program. And finally, and most importantly, the projects that have been implemented have served as powerful examples of how local churches are really the first line when it comes to providing essential educational, healthcare, and other social services in humanitarian crisis, even if we compare them to the international organizations or the local authorities. They are also the ones people turn to when trouble hits. Therefore, their support is the most efficient way of aiding those in the greatest of needs in the most vulnerable communities. So in conclusion, I can report to you that as a result of the projects implemented with the aid of Hungary Helps throughout the world, today we can estimate that we have contributed to the preservation, to the prosperity and the dignified return of over 100,000 people to their homelands. Now, as I begin my remarks, there are 260 million persecuted Christians in the world. If we have provided aid to 100,000, that still leaves about 259,900,000 persecuted Christians. So what we offer here is only an example. And I believe that there must be even more efficient methods than what we use in Hungary Helps. And I think that the mission of today's event is that we find even better ways to save lives. If we are on the right track, time will tell. But that's for certainty that the first step is honest discussion about Christian persecution, is about listening to those who are in need, and it is about to join forces and create a global coalition for the aid of persecuted Christians and other persecuted religious minorities. So thank you for being part of this important mission. I'm always glad and proud to share this mission with you. I'm wishing all of us a fruitful discussion today, and thank you very much for your kind attention.
Thank you so much, Secretary Azbez. I cannot stress enough and say thank you again for the incredible work that the Hungarian government is doing to aid persecuted Christians and really paving the way on filling in this nexus on how persecution drives the need for humanitarian aid. Excellent remarks. Thank you so much. I want to now introduce our next speaker, our very own President of International Christian Concern, Mr. Jeff King. He served as president of ICC since 2002. Prior to that, he served and worked in banking as well as served in overseas missions. He's traveled to over 75 countries with this mission and has worked tirelessly to expand and grow the mission of ICC to serve the persecuted Christians and really to make ICC what it is today. So Jeff, please, floor is yours.
Thank you, Matthias. 3 years ago, Maurice Jedel's life changed dramatically. She was sitting in her hut in Nigeria, she and her family. She hears the shouts of angry men, foreign men, not from her area, screaming at the women to come out. And she doesn't need to be told what to do. She's in Nigeria's middle belt. So she knows the Fulanis have arrived and that her life and her family's life is in grave danger. So she immediately, everyone gets up and they go running for the bush. And she and her son are running together. Her son, Confidence, is trying to keep up, but he's 25 years old, he's an adult. He's trying to keep up, but he's sick. And she's yelling at him, please, Confidence, keep up. And that's when she heard his last words crying out, Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. And she turned around and she saw the Fulanis and machetes raining down on him, ending his life. Frozen in horror, of course, and then they pounced on her. They raised their machetes and she instinctively put her hand up to block them, and the machete came down and took off part of her hand. They raised the machete again. She did the same thing, more of her hand came off, and then she fell to the ground and they started hacking and slashing at her. And luckily, they had slashed open her clothes and they saw she had a money belt. And that was enough to distract them. And they were so excited about their good fortune that they ran off and left her, terribly wounded, but alive. Three different villages were attacked that day. There was Maurice's and two others. They're all pretty close together. They're kind of family villages. And there were dozens wounded, dozens killed. And that is one of thousands and thousands of attacks. This has been going on for 20 years. Not just Boko, but it's Fulanis, probably even the more deadly group. And we've been working in there probably for about the last 15 years. And one thing we noticed over and over was the success of our farming projects. And that's not a big surprise. The victims are mostly farmers. And so we do different things. We say, my gosh, these farming projects worked well. And we eventually said, you know what, we need to start large communal farms. And what we do is we go in and we rent the land, we till it, we plow it, and then we bring the victims in and we say, what do you need? Seed, fertilizer, pesticide, water pumps for when they're doing rice farms, but basically whatever they need, and we get them back on their feet and back to their old way of life. You know, in Maurice's case, that's, you know, we started a communal farm for her, and we visited her about 1 year after the attack. And it was interesting because she, her whole family was out working on the farm in their portion of it. And so we had our interview right there in the rice field. And the thing that was so striking is that she was, she seemed so normal in spite of all the trauma she'd been through. Full of hope, thankful, full of gratitude, of course, right? And now the crazy thing is that we did that for $30. For one victim, it's $30, and that's period, that's it. And that's the total cost to get a victim back on their feet. Now, without that aid, you think about it, what would she be like? And if you've seen the flow of refugees, internally displaced people within Nigeria that are victims of the Fulani or Boko, you know, these people are not full of hope. They're not encouraged. They're dejected. They're without hope. And honestly, a lot of them are looking to get to Europe or even the United States, but it's easier to get to Europe. And they're thinking, how can we get to Europe where there's jobs and life and safety? And, you know, we can't take in all the world's refugees in spite of our goodwill and our good intentions, but we can't do it politically. We can't do it economically. And apart from that, it's a disaster for the countries with the refugees. You know, you take a country and you take out their most energetic, their most industrious, most courageous people. And where does that leave that country? And where does it leave their economy in the long term? So it's a disaster on numerous fronts that we need to work on. And that's where we find ourselves today. We're at the nexus of government, of NGOs, and the victim, and trying to figure out, what do we do? How do we help these people practically? You know, I think we work pretty well in terms of advocacy. We're coordinating well with each other. We work synergistically, but that's not the case so much with practical help. It's fairly siloed. But luckily today we have three leading forces in the world on this issue. And first of all, Matthias, I think you said it well with Hungary and what we're amazed at the country of Hungary and what they're doing. And it's really a world-leading role. And I know it's not without controversy, but for those of us in the religious persecution community, we're just amazed. In addition to that, of course, and that's Tristan Asbez. And of course, we have USAID here with Simon Norquist. And finally, Samaritan's Purse, one of the world-leading NGOs in this space. And thanks to Todd Chastain for being here. You know, hopefully today we're going to take a small step forward in integration and help. And we want to reach out a hand to the victim. And that's not to give them a handout, but rather to give them, restore them to a place of dignity and a place of productivity right where they're at, back in their own countries. And I think today we're going to make some progress on that. I just want to thank everybody for coming.
Thank you, Jeff. That is excellent remarks, and really just gives a perspective, especially about the story you shared on how the humanitarian aid comes and restores and rebuilds and really helps people come back on their feet after being faced with such a horrible circumstance of religious persecution. And that's why we're doing this event. That's why we exist, you know, as ICC. That's why Hungry Helps exists, and that's why all these organizations that are here today partly exist and continue to push this work forward. Thank you, Jeff. And I want to introduce our following speaker, His Excellency Matthew Hassan Kuka, Bishop of the Catholic Diocese in Sokoto, Nigeria. He's a prominent voice for human rights and has extensive experience in serving the Nigerian people in various facets, including as a member of the Nigerian Investigation Commission of Humanitarian Rights Violations. He was secretary of the National Political Reform Conference 2005. And from 2005 onwards, he has been serving as the chairman of the ongoing Ogoni Shell Reconciliation Program. And we're so honored, sir, that you're here with us today. And we want to give you the floor.
Thank you very much, Matthias, and let me thank Andrew Crane, who kept communication with me quite effectively and efficiently kept reminding me. And let me greet everybody. Good morning to you all, although it's late afternoon here in Nigeria. Baroness Cox, good to see you again. And you know, Tristan, you've made my job both difficult and easy because I think you've really captured very clearly the issues. But I think what is even more important, and you probably were quite modest in dealing with that, is this breaking of completely new grounds in the way and manner that the world has dealt with the issues of the persecution of Christians. I mean, you speak rather modestly of 100,000, reaching 100,000 people, but the easy question is to say, you know, like Peter said to Jesus, we've got only just this limited supply of fish and bread. But what is that to thousands of people? I think everything placed in the hands of God just has a way of multiplying, especially with his love. So you've already set the path. And I really want to use this opportunity, I guess, on behalf of the good people of Nigeria, the Christian community, to thank the government of the people of Hungary for, you know, talking the walk. You know, it's beyond just talking now. We've spent a lot of years listening to concerns from the United Nations and the international community, trying to deal with the issues of persecution, not only of Christians, but other difficult issues by employing such strategies as denunciation, condemnation, sanctions, punitive threats, declaration of countries as pariah states, you know, travel bans on politicians, the 2005 Laudable Initiative by the United Nations on the right to protect. But most of these, or hardly any of these, have done anything to change the lives of ordinary people. It doesn't matter how many politicians you stop from traveling abroad. It doesn't put bread on anybody's table. And it doesn't matter how many of them you try in the ICC, it doesn't change people's lives. So I think what is most spectacular and commendable about this initiative is the fact that the impact is not only qualitative, but it's also measurable. And I think really this is what is very significant. And I think that is really one of the first and most important points that I would like to make. The second thing is also flowing directly from that, is to acknowledge the fact that, and here I draw from the Christian tradition because we are Christians. There is a sense in which we are people of the resurrection, you know, and unless the seed falls to the ground, it does not grow. What is significant about all this development is not the number of people who are dying, but what we decide to do in terms of preserving their memories and so on. So this global show of solidarity means a lot to us as Christians. And I think perhaps the most important thing that we need to start thinking about and talking about and visualizing much more clearly is strategy, namely, what are the best strategies for us to adopt? I think Jeff made the point, you know, that whatever we do in these initiatives, our intention is not to move people out of their immediate habitats. In a country like Nigeria, we are the Christian community in Nigeria. By any standard at all, you know, we're not like other Christian vulnerable communities in other parts of the world. We constitute, you know, about 45 or 48% of the Nigerian population. We also perhaps account for about 80% of the educated elites of Nigeria. We also account for about perhaps 70 or 80% control of the economy. So we're not dealing with what you may call a vulnerable group that should elicit tears of pity and so on. No, it is that really what is happening to Christians in Nigeria, it's changed in the last few years, but it caught global attention largely because of the global, you know, attention brought about by Boko Haram. But really the truth is that this has been a slow burning fuse. That is as old as and actually even precedes the Nigerian state. We just celebrated 60 years of independence. But what is interesting is that the relationship between Christians and Muslims in Nigeria, the seeds of this tension and conflict and its inevitability, were sown even before the emergence of modern Nigeria. And going back to the 19th century, you know, when the British came first to trade before the establishment of the colonial empire, the literature is very, very clear on the overbearing attitude of the colonial government that focused on the preservation of the sanctity of the Islamic space. The Islamic, what is now, I mean, what was then known as the Sokoto Caliphate, covered perhaps what is now almost 60% of the landmass of what is now modern Nigeria. And before independence in 1960, the British deliberately decided to keep Christians out of northern Nigeria under a policy that the British referred to as the policy of non-interference, with the assumption that Islam needed to be protected because it was much more compliant. It wasn't causing the kind of problem that quote unquote Christians were causing by virtue of their access to Western education. The result of that is that the infrastructure of state, and indeed subsequently political power, was literally entrusted by the British into the hands of the Hausa Fulani ruling class. The rest of Nigeria's independence has been a strenuous effort by non-Northerners and non-Muslims, you know, to more or less take back power, also to make up for them, to try to resolve the contradiction of them having such a wealth of education and such a wealth of capital, and yet finding themselves unable to have the required impact in public life. Things have come to a tragic head in the last few years since the ascension of General Buhari to power, who himself is a retired general, a Muslim, and a Northerner. But we've never seen, I mean, we were literally closing this gap of suspicion, fear, and anxiety between Christians and Muslims when in 2014, during his campaign, the chairman of the campaign council was a Christian, a Catholic. The chairman of the political party was a Christian, was also a Catholic. But no sooner did the president ascend to power than he began to run a policy that has severely destroyed the foundations of our common identity as Christians. Today, as we are speaking, despite Boko Haram, about 85% of the security forces are in the hands of Muslims, even from the point of view of public office. So there has been a clear manifestation of what you may call, maybe it's too strong to use the word anti-Christian, but it is that Christians have now found it increasingly difficult to find themselves at the heart of the Nigerian state. We've not fought a war, Christians have not lost a war, you know, but we've felt so pressurized. And the result is that the persecution, what we now see in the Northeast and other places, people want to cover up the issues by saying, well, Muslims are also being killed, which is true, there's absolutely no doubt about that. But we must not lose sight of the source of inspiration of Boko Haram and what it is that energizes them. And I have argued elsewhere that indeed, when the president puts so much power and privilege in the hands of Northern Muslims, he literally inadvertently gives oxygen, you know, to the things that Boko Haram is trying to do. So going forward, and let me try and end, it is to say, first of all, I think we need a much clearer strategy. And I think that the humanitarian option is perhaps, you know, the most visible, the most effective strategy, in part because the story that Jeff told, you can replicate that story, and he himself admitted, that is the daily menu of many families and many Christians. So again, it is that by making the effort, as little as $30 as you say, our ability to get children back to school, whether they are orphans or vulnerable children back to school, is the guarantee that we have for the future of Christianity. Helping people to rebuild their lives and so on and so forth. And I think one of the most beautiful things to arise from all this is that in the course of doing this, we are also finding opportunities to interact with the poor segment of the Muslim community. In our own situation, in a place like Sokoto, the schools that we are building are schools that in many cases we have over 50% of the children being Muslims. And for me, this is very significant because it guarantees a less divisive society, you know, when we begin to think about the future. So I think that if we invest in infrastructure, building of schools, rehabilitation, you know, getting children, especially girls, back to school. We will be moving away from the moral exhortation that has always characterized these initiatives. And hopefully, we should be able to build a very, very functional society. In Zamfara, for example, we're almost finishing the building of our primary school. The Muslims in the state had decided they were not going to send their children to any school until the Catholic Church had finished building its school. So we're in Nigeria, we're not having a situation in which Christians and Muslims are going around with daggers looking for one another. No, we are just victims of terribly and thoroughly bad politics. And my hope is that what we are doing by dealing with humanitarianism gives hope, both for the message of Christianity, and it also guarantees a much more peaceful society for the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bishop Kuka. That's an excellent presentation on the political context that we're dealing with in Nigeria. And your experience there is so welcomed, and we thank you for those comments. I would like to move us along to our next speaker, Todd Chasteen, who serves as the, did I say that correctly, Chasteen? I've always wondered about that.
Yes, you did.
Excellent. I'm not butchering it. I like that. Todd serves as the Vice President of Public Policy and General Counsel at Samaritan's Purse, which is, of course, a faith-based international crisis relief agency, providing humanitarian assistance in over 100 countries. In fact, you guys did some work in New York not too long ago, which we were happy to see that. In a public policy role, he works with policy matters such as domestic and international religious freedom. He recently served as a facilitator for the Special Advisory Group of the World Summit in Defense of Persecuted Christians. He served on the ECFA panel for legal experts, making recommendations to Congress related to nonprofit best practices, and was member of the Advisory Committee on Self-Regulation of the Charitable Sector. He was also a member of the Government Oversight and Self-Regulation Work Group for the panel on the nonprofit sector that made recommendations to the U.S. Senate Finance Committee. Mr. Chasteen is a member of the North Carolina State Board of Education. And I memorized that entire bio, so kudos to me. But sir, the floor is yours. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Matthias. It's great to see the energy behind each ministerial, and I'm also thankful for the great ICC team. You've really helped inform our leadership. For example, the wonderful Nigerian update you did at the Capitol a few years ago, very well done, very helpful to our team. So we thank you for your work. These initiatives are really significant to each one of us because we want to figure out, find a way to determine our strengths, how we can use those strengths and tools and resources to help people of all faiths who are facing oppression, including our brothers and sisters in Christ. We want to know what really helps. We try to figure out how do we help them withstand constant pressure, threat, maintain a presence, fulfill their mission. And we wrestle with those questions often and consistently. And several years ago, you may know our CEO, Franklin Graham, felt compelled to hold a world summit in defense of persecuted Christians. One of the most special things about that event was there was 125 survivors of persecution there, including family members from the martyrs that lost their lives on the shores of Libya, folks that have really escaped from extreme persecution countries, folks that have been locked up in prisons, containers. There was also religious freedom advocates, religious leaders, members of Congress, scholars. And there was a lot of energy there. It was at a time where ISIS had yet to be defeated. And if you can remember, Piers Morgan had just called out the media for ignoring the persecution of Christians around the world. But a lot of participants at the summit were inspired, and they kept asking us, well, what's next? What else can we do? And we thought of things like, there was, of course, advocacy with Congress, the Iraq-Syria Genocide Act. There was sign-on letters, roundtables, historical ministerials that were going to take place, a growing emphasis in foreign policy, solidarity with the release of prisoners, letters to the president. All these of course, invaluable, strategic, necessary, and good, and we join them when feasible. But when asking the question, what else can we do? What's next? part of the answer was we had already been doing it. For decades, we've been helping people of all faiths in their darkest hour facing oppression, tangibly sharing God's love. Years ago, hundreds of churches in Sudan were targeted and destroyed. We decided to help the Christian community by rebuilding 512 churches. Every time a church was rebuilt, it was a message to the community that you were not forgotten. And it also provided a place for the community to meet and gather for various reasons. There's a photo over my shoulder that really shows the joy experienced after each church reopening. Very, very special. SP also worked in Northern Iraq before ISIS, during ISIS, post-ISIS, and humanitarian aid was a key aspect of that. We had the internally displaced persons camps where you provided shelter, heat, nutrition, then trauma counseling. And after that, we did a 15,000 family survey to find out what it would take for Christians to return to their ancestral towns where they had been driven from. And then from there, we discovered that a housing project would be helpful. So we restored homes where thousands could return to Karakash, Bashika, Bartella. And then on top of that, livelihoods such as beekeeping, honey, nutrition, agroforestry. With all those kind of things coming together, you could see how humanitarian aid from our organization and so many others was a key aspect of helping in a religious freedom setting where there was great need. So there's so many dimensions of aid that benefit religious freedom. So one of our best tools can be humanitarian aid for aiding religious freedom. And in fact, I would say in some sense, strategic humanitarian aid is just another form of advocacy. For example, we're not able to help anybody unless we tell the story, we raise awareness. And because God places on the hearts of generous givers the desire to want to intervene, to help, to give. And in those situations, with the awareness of these plights, resources can be marshaled to meet existential needs. And there you see advocacy, awareness, and aid coming together hand in hand. Also, experience has shown us that humanitarian aid delivery can be open doors for us to speak to government officials in those countries, even sometimes at high levels. And for those facing the violence and the persecution, knowing others stand in solidarity with their suffering and will take action to bring stability gives them a reason to remain. Strategic aid can also help the church survive and pursue its mission. In Niger, Christians are a religious minority. Dozens of churches had been destroyed years ago. We stepped up to rebuild 66 churches in Niger. Some of the villagers said just the sight of the visible church structure in their village stood as a symbol of their past presence and future presence and lifted their spirits, even as a disfavored group. And aid also helps to maintain a presence and withstand the pressure to flee. ICC's assistance in the Middle Belt of Nigeria is a great example of this, from the aggression coming from the north, from Fulani, Boko Haram, being in Juba last year, not Juba, in Abuja last year, listening to some of the pastors and how this assistance helps an already resilient people withstand the pressure is so key. And ICC is doing incredible work there to help. Another wonderful means that's already been mentioned is that strengthening the local church by working through them to help people of all faiths. When we provide them with the resources to bless people of all faiths in the community, whatever, because other faiths are facing poverty, famine, disaster, it gives them a great relationship builder. It also is a way that pluralism can be seen as good in the region. So we provide them with the tools to love thy neighbor. So you can see humanitarian aid has another wonderful dimension there. Of course, our crisis relief programs around the world, even when we're working in predominantly non-Christian cultures, can open hearts and minds for others to be more accepting of religious minorities, including Christians. And so you see the dynamics of humanitarian aid and the nexus clearly shown. there are complexities. As aid organizations, we have to register with the host country. If the host country is the bad actor, we can't call them out publicly, or we could lose our registration and put our staff on the ground in danger. But that's not always the case. When 34-year Congressman Frank Wolf traveled with me and our security and projects teams across the Nineveh Plains to Mosul, to Sinjar, climbed in ISIS tunnels, saw the mass grave, he immediately returned to Washington, D.C. and advocated with Congress, with the administration, for direct aid to the Christians and Yazidis. Here, aid and advocacy blended beautifully. Some of the other challenges are gaining access to a region where there's intense persecution and violence, establishing security, planning for sustainability of programs. These are just components of aid in a precarious and fragile setting. Of course, developing an infrastructure where you have dedicated, competent, sacrificial staff who with skills who can work in high intensity environments can take years to develop. In Mosul, we set up an emergency field hospital 15 kilometers from the fighting with ISIS. We had double barriers, a wonderful security force, but our team, our healthcare providers, they knew that ISIS was only miles away, one of the most evil forces we had experienced in decades. But when at a meal break, Frank Wolf and I talked to a couple of nurses, and one thing they said just still stays in my mind. They told us there's no other place on the earth they'd rather be at that moment, at that time, helping those people. And so great staff is incredible. Also working with great partners when we don't have a footprint. ICC has been one of those incredible partners in their farming program in the Middle Belt, where they provided the farmland, the seed, the fertilizer, the equipment, and the hope for just thousands of people to have food for their families and to provide livelihoods. ICC's tripod approach of aid, awareness, and advocacy used many tools in the toolbox in that program. It lets the people know they're not forgotten. We all long to figure out who we can help, how, what works, what doesn't. We don't do it perfectly, but we're willing and often able. Hebrews 6:10, sacred text, says that Lord will not forget your work as you continue to minister to the saints. Galatians 6:10 says that do good to everyone, especially the household of the faith. And then Corinthians discusses when one part of the body suffers, we all suffer with it. No doubt that aid to the persecuted of all faiths and is an enduring way to bring hope, strength, ability, and courage. And scripture calls us to do no less. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Todd. I love that example that you gave from Niger and Sudan in rebuilding the churches. It really speaks to the heart of the matter in terms of the policy side of restoring religious freedom in those areas and really rebuilding the faith lives of these persecuted communities. Such a huge part of what we're discussing today and all the work you do at Samaritan's Purse. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And I'd like to move us along to our final presenter today, certainly not least, Saman Nyquist, who serves as the Chief Advisor for International Religious Freedom to the Administrator of USAID. And Saman was actually just appointed to this role in July earlier this year. And in this new capacity, Mrs. Nyquist will lead or leads USAID's implementation of President Trump's Executive Order on Advancing International Religious Freedom, which elevates the U.S. government's prioritization of religious freedom as a moral and national security imperative. The executive order further solidifies religious freedom as a foundational principle of American foreign policy and directs the Secretary of State in consultation with the Administrator of USAID to develop a plan to integrate international religious freedom into U.S. bilateral and multilateral foreign assistance and diplomacy. So no small task for Mrs. Nyquist and in wielding the bureaucracy that is at USAID, but we're so grateful you're here with us. The floor is yours. You're on mute, Sama. There we go.
Sorry, can you hear me now? Hello, everyone, and thank you for having me. I'm very humbled and grateful for the opportunity to be serving in the Trump administration. As a Muslim American who has been working to respond to atrocities that have taken place in northern Iraq for the last 2.5 years, and now it's an honor to be able to address you today in my official capacity as a Chief Advisor for International Religious Freedom at the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. I don't exaggerate when I say that the Trump administration has made historic leaps and gains on international religious freedom in the last 4 years, from providing relief to those in Iraq and Syria, to the signing of the Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act. Persecuted people are significantly better off than they were 4 years ago. And under the leadership of President Trump and Vice President Pence, USAID has transformed into a powerful vehicle to protect and respond to acts of persecution across the globe. We take very seriously this responsibility and hope that you all will continue to hold us accountable to this standard in the years ahead. I want to start off by thanking Marais and ICC at large for inviting me to participate and for hosting this important event. I also want to thank the government of Hungary for hosting and its invaluable partnership and leadership on these issues. Religious freedom is on the retreat across the world, and discrimination, harassment, and persecution against communities of faith is getting much worse. People of all backgrounds, including Christians, Buddhists, Hindus, Jews, Muslims, and Sikhs, have been negatively impacted in different ways. Extremist groups, ongoing wars, and tyrants contribute to this trend. But there are also authoritarian regimes, like the Chinese Communist Party, which have made it a core function of their governance to persecute people of faith. I want to be very clear here. The Chinese Communist Party is responsible for one of the worst human rights abuses in modern history. Their systematic acts of violence and sustained campaign of ethnic cleansing in Xinjiang bears all the warning signs and hallmarks of a worsening and government-supported genocide. Our conscience is shocked by reports of the PRC's record of forced abortions, the killing of innocent and defenseless life, intrusive surgical birth prevention mechanisms, mass sterilization, and other measures to systematically suppress birth rates and depress population growth, including the internment of mothers who violate birth control policies or even have children. The PRC's record on birth suppression and other atrocities, with some experts estimating that 1.5 million chiefly Muslim minority groups are being interned, deserves the same level of international attention and investigation for crimes against humanity as we saw with the so-called Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. I hope that my colleagues and those at the United Nations will continue to see these investigations out. Besides those being committed by the CCP, other atrocities across the globe require our attention and action. Christians in Nigeria face intense violence from radical Islamist groups like Boko Haram and Islamic State West Africa. Rohingya Muslims are subject to ethnic cleansing in Burma. And the Catholic Church in Nicaragua has been systematically oppressed by daring to speak out against the Ortega regime. All of these groups are facing tragedy because of their faith, and we cannot turn a blind eye towards them. Now, even with all of this calamity, there's certainly a lot to be hopeful for and progress to be celebrated. And we've had our fair share of success over the past 4 years. Nowhere is this success better illustrated than our work in Iraq and Syria, following the campaign of genocide against Christian and Yazidi communities. Since 2017, USAID has invested over $400 million to rehabilitate, revive, and restore Christian and Yazidi communities in Iraq and Syria. In Syria, we are partnering with the Greek Orthodox Patriarch of Antioch, Department of Ecumenical Relations and Development in Syria to provide valuable job training to religious and ethnic minorities. This training will provide employment and business management skills and access to credit so people can rebuild their ventures after years of conflict. In Northern Iraq, we've rehabilitated homes, provided health and psychosocial care, refurbished schools and hospitals, restored water sanitation systems, improved access to electricity, and assisted local businesses. We've helped countless displaced persons return to their ancient homelands. Most importantly, we've delivered a new sense of stability and hope to so many. But it wouldn't be honest to say this work is just a product of USAID. These results wouldn't be possible if it wasn't for the new partnerships initiatives, NPI, which allowed us to partner with local and faith-based organizations on the ground. One group I want to highlight is the Shlama Foundation, which trains engineers on the installation of solar-powered equipment for family households, agricultural farms, and street lighting for villages. This program has not only given young people jobs, but also is providing clean and renewable energy to hundreds of families in northern Iraq. Shlama is exactly the type of group we want to focus on building partnerships with. Low cost, high impact, and locally focused. This new formula, NPI, or partnering with local groups, is the key to USAID's success in the future. Our work with victims of ISIS genocide in northern Iraq offered us many lessons learned on how to respond to the needs of the communities of faith that are targeted because of their faith. In Nigeria, Christian communities and other vulnerable groups face continuous attacks and destruction by Boko Haram, the Islamic State in West, and other jihadists. In Nigeria, USAID contributed nearly $316 million in humanitarian assistance to vulnerable people affected by conflict in Northeast Nigeria, including those targeted for their faith. This work will continue in the future. We also strongly believe in the role of local and faith-based organizations to identify the needs and the credibility they have with communities on the ground. We are engaging to work more directly with local faith-based organizations so that our aid can reach communities at the grassroots level. We hope to preserve Nigeria's democratic, mosaic, and pluralistic system and protect these persecuted groups. And thanks to our progress, all that, President Trump gave us a powerful tool to advance religious freedom by signing an executive order that mandates the integration of religious freedom into US foreign policy and assistance. This executive order will help us implement and fund these types of programs across the globe. We expect this executive order to carry on into the future, recognizing the strong bipartisan support this issue has always received. Now I'd like to close by charting a vision for how foreign assistance can continue to promote international religious freedom, specifically by fully utilizing President Trump's executive order. As I stated just a second ago, the president's executive order directs the State Department and USAID to expand our existing efforts and realign foreign aid to better reflect individual country circumstances when it comes to international religious freedom. But it's not the White House who primarily carries out this order. It's officials at the State Department and USAID who are tasked with the implementation of it. As we speak, our Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, is finalizing an action plan to enshrine religious freedom as a key priority in US diplomacy and foreign assistance. And that plan is delivering on many of the things that folks like you have advocated. I expect the plan to direct USAID to use its on-the-ground presence and convening power to highlight America's commitment to religious freedom. The plan will encourage ambassadors and USAID country teams to develop country-specific action plans to advance religious freedom, addressing the specific challenges and opportunities in every local context. I also expect the plan will require our ambassadors and USAID missions to advance comprehensive multi-year strategies in the most challenging countries where there are systematic, ongoing, and egregious violations of religious freedom. This is a comprehensive vision encompassing USAID's activities and equities. It delivers on President's policy directions for USAID to engage robustly and continuously with civil society to meet the needs of vulnerable religious communities. More importantly, it provides a strong foundation to continue advancing international religious freedom. As I have emphasized, USAID is a powerful vehicle to advance international freedom, but none of this would have been possible without all of you. Your advocacy truly makes a difference here and allows us to accomplish incredible things in such a short amount of time. Your voice will always be the difference on how the world chooses to respond to the needs of faith communities around the world. And you must always hold us accountable every step of the way. As I like to tell my team, these programs aren't just dollar figures. They tell real life stories of how America chooses to save lives and how America brings hope to persecuted peoples around the world. We must never forget that when doing this work. Thanks again for having me. It's an honor to be with all of you. God bless you and God bless all the work you do. Thank you.
Thank you, Sama. So appreciate all the work you're doing and your team is doing at USAID. I love to hear your comments, because something I always think about is how the U.S. should always lead with its values, and seeing this actually play out as it is really realizing that value in action. And I love to see that. I'm sure everybody here agrees with that. So thank you for everything you're doing. I'm grateful for the Trump administration as well and all their work in religious freedom and all the faithful public servants there. I'd like to move us along to our panel discussion. We have three individuals who will be presenting some remarks, and then we will move on into our Q&A. I will go ahead and just introduce all of our panelists at this time. First, we have Baroness Cox. She's a humanitarian aid worker and has taken that mission to many conflict zones, allowing her to obtain the firsthand evidence of human rights violations and humanitarian needs. Areas she's traveled in include Armenia, Syria, Sudan, Nigeria, Uganda, and Karen and Karani, Shan and Chin people in the jungles of Burma and the communities suffering from conflicts in Indonesia. She has also visited North Korea, helping to promote parliamentary initiatives and medical programs there. Additionally, Caroline has been instrumental in helping to change former Soviet Union policies for orphaned and abandoned children from institutional to foster family care. We're so grateful you're here with us today. Our second panelist is Evelina Otraub. She's a human rights advocate for the Coalition of Genocide Response. She's a legal researcher and human rights and advocate, of course, and author of the book, Never Again, A Legal Response to a Broken Promise in the Middle East. She works on the topic of persecution of minorities, religious minorities around the world, with primary projects including the Daesh genocide in Syria, Iraq, Boko Haram, atrocities in West Africa, and the situation of religious minorities in South Asia. And I believe she is still working on her PhD, so good luck to her studies there. Finally, we have our very own ICC field expert in Nigeria, who's been with ICC for several years now, working as our field expert and staff member, where he leads much of the work that you've heard about today, and especially our farms projects. He has been an instrumental part of our team, ensuring that these people that we serve receive the best support that we can possibly offer them. He's an expert in the situation in Nigeria, and due to the security reasons, we've concealed his identity during this presentation. We will lead with his prepared remarks. We have a video from him, and following that, we would like Baroness Cox, if you will go, and then Evelina to carry us out into the Q&A. So Andrew, if you could play the video at this time. Thank you.
Two decades, 20 years of systematic, coordinated persecution of Christians in Nigeria. Thinking about this often reminds me of how the Midianites constantly invaded the communities of the Israelites in those days, leading to a state of abject poverty and impoverishment. The violent attacks in mainly northern Nigeria is a perfect combination of ethnic, economic, political, and religious invasion, with religion as the driving force. I've personally been to several of these communities, seen, met, and heard from victims, so I know exactly what I'm talking about. The humanitarian crises have been colossal, but because the Nigerian government prefers the herder farmers clash narrative, which gives the impression of a two-man fight left to the two-man to resolve by themselves, the response to the humanitarian needs have been very dismal. Response has been largely left to kind-spirited individuals and non-governmental organizations. As much as I know, the response of ICC in some of these communities that have suffered the devastating attacks is among the most strategic and sustainable. Several injured victims have received emergency medical aid running into millions in local currency. And God be praised, so many of those victims have recovered and are alive today. Direct food relief have been provided to hundreds of families and orphans across the region. Education support for children whose one or both parents were killed. Rescue intervention for minor Christian girls who have been abducted, forcefully converted to Islam, and forcefully married off without the consent of their parents as required by the Nigerian Constitution. One of the very impactful and sustainable interventions of ICC is through the communal farm projects. Most of the victims of the Fulani militants' attacks are Christian farmers. The communal farms have helped to restore the sense of worth and human dignity of the farming communities. The communities provide land measuring 30, 25, or 20 hectares, depending on the number of families to benefit. ICC provides funding for tractor hire plowing, quality seeds, fertilizer, weed control herbicides, and the sprayers, and water pumping machines for irrigation farming. Just all that the farmers need. They just go out to the fields and work on the farms, and it's all theirs. The results have been awesome. They get good harvest, have enough food to live on, sell some to pay their children's school fees, and save seeds for the next farming season. That is a sure path to economic recovery. These projects restore hope, encourage them to persevere in their faith, and reassure these victims that Christians around the world know about the pains they are going through and care enough to send a helping hand. What else can be more fulfilling than touching lives in a meaningful and sustainable way?
Thank you, Andrew, for the video. We will now move on to Baroness Caroline Cox. And forgive me, I forgot to mention, of course, she is the CEO of Humanitarian Aid Relief Trust. So please, Baroness, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much for the great privilege taking part in this very important and significant forum. And I really appreciate all that's been said and agree with every word that's been spoken. I just mentioned to begin with that only late last night I returned from Armenia, and 2 days before then I was in the little Shazi enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh or Artsakh that is suffering a renewed genocide. Thousands of Christians have been killed. People have been beheaded and tortured. The Red Cross will not allow access, or not allowed access by Azerbaijan to prisoners of war, Armenian prisoners of war, but there are stories of the horrendous atrocities being perpetrated against them. It is a new genocide, and I hope it will come up very quickly as a main agenda for a forum such as this, because the needs are legion and virtually nobody is in there helping those who are suffering. And just on Friday, I was joining thousands of Armenians having to flee their land, and it took 18 hours to do a journey, which can be done four, because the road was just packed with people fleeing with their possessions, with their cattle, their livestock, and it is a desperately serious situation of a new genocide. But today we're focusing on Nigeria. And may I just say that I've had the privilege of visiting Nigeria many times, northern states, often when Boko Haram was perpetrating its atrocities, and Central Belt, where the Islamist Fulani groups are carrying out their activities. I would call it a genocide. And it's not just land grab, as the British government says, but it is killings of thousands, it has been mentioned, but also terrorism. And I'll just give two examples of the atrocities which indicate that it is not just killings, it is atrocities and terrorism. I had the poignant, horrible privilege of hugging and crying with a young mother when the Fulani attacked her village. She tried to flee with her six-year-old daughter. She is surrounded by other Fulani. They slashed with a machete, and they said, "Your daughter would love to suck her mother's finger." So they amputated her forefinger. She passed out. When she came round, her little six-year-old daughter was lying dead next to her with her mother's finger in her mouth. And then another lady I met, the Fulani, Islamist Fulani, amputated her left arm, and then she put up her hand to try to protect her face as they tried to attack her face, and she saw all her fingers falling off in front of her. So she's left unable to do anything because she has no hands, workable hands left to do anything. I'm afraid I could multiply those examples many, many, many times. But it is, I think, evidence that what is going on there is not just land grab, as the British government says, but it really is terrorism, as well as the killings of thousands of people and driving them off their lands. So there is a need, a huge need for aid. There's a huge need for post-traumatic stress and treatment for those who suffered the atrocities and the tortures. And I think there's nothing like enough provision of medical care for those who have suffered these horrendous atrocities, as well as the psychological care. As we know, there are many thousands who are displaced and driven off their lands, and they desperately need help. I've been very critical of the British government because the British government refuses to provide any help to those suffering in Middle Belt, the people I've just been talking about, thousands displaced, atrocities perpetrated, and they receive no help from the British government. And I can't get a sensible answer why the British government is not providing help to Middle Belt. But I would plead with those others of you who do provide help and do so so professionally and so brilliantly, please do bear in mind that Middle Belt suffers enormously. And I know at the moment there's a huge amount of unmet need in Middle Belt. So the needs are legion. Just very briefly, I will mention that two positive things. One is our little organization, HEART. We do provide aid. We're very small, but emergency aid for medicine and food for people who have absolutely nothing. But we also try to propose and promote reconciliation, as I mentioned earlier on, a school which combined both Muslim and Christian students to try to de-radicalize, to try to enable the Muslim Christian young people to understand each other and not to be subjected to the teachings of hate that are imposed by the Fulani or Boko Haram. And finally, I'm happy to say that the all-party parliamentary group for freedom of religion and belief in the United Kingdom, we did produce a report which does get a lot of the truth on the record. It's called Nigeria Unfolding Genocide? It has a lot of the statistics, a lot of the reality reported very accurately and evidence-based, as well as the real problems to do with land demand and climate change and so on. So, you know, like a copy of that report, it's been very well received, and it's by the all-party parliamentary group in the UK for freedom of religion and belief. So those are the positive things we're trying to do to help people who are suffering so much. And I'll just go back to that quotation from St. Paul's letter to the church in Corinth: when one part of the body of Christ suffers, we all suffer. And may I say to our Nigerian friends, we really do suffer. with you and for you, but suffering without action is not much good. So we try to put our pain into practice to help your people holding your front line of faith and freedom for the rest of us. Thank you for letting me say my few words of pain and passion.
Thank you, Baroness. Your experience and context you bring to the conversation is invaluable. Look forward to having some more discussions with you as well. I want to introduce, excuse me, Evelina, the floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for organizing this important session. And a big kudos to all panelists, of course, not only for your presentations, but above it all for your very important work. And only a few months ago, in preparation for an article for Forbes, I interviewed Sama and her colleague Hal Ferguson on the US aid assistance to religious minorities once targeted by Daesh for annihilation in Iraq. And they said something that I would like to mention here, and I would like us all to think about it and hopefully implement in our work if we are not doing it by now. And it goes as follows. Providing assistance to communities persecuted for their religion or belief differs from providing humanitarian assistance in other scenarios, for example, in cases of natural disasters. And so they said, responding to such atrocities as the genocide by Daesh against religious minorities requires a variety of activities that are needed to stitch traumatized communities back together. It requires more than just rebuilding infrastructure. For example, there remains a lot of trauma within the targeted communities that still requires attention even now, 6 years after the atrocities. In response, USAID and the State Department have focused on using different tools to try to help those communities in a holistic way, addressing both physical and mental health needs. And this is also an important lesson for other countries who respond to cases of genocide or religious persecution more broadly. And as Ambassador Asbesh said earlier today as well, the provision of humanitarian assistance cannot be done in a vacuum. And indeed, the provision of humanitarian assistance needs to take into account human rights situations, violations of human rights, and in the cases that we discussed today, religious persecution in the various manifestations and severity. Better integrating human rights and indeed the right to freedom of religion, belief, and humanitarian assistance can help to address religious inequalities that lead to some of those violations, mass atrocities, which then in turn produce situations requiring humanitarian assistance. And integrating human rights and the right to FORP and humanitarian assistance means also being equipped to better understand the situation and the needs of the people targeted for persecution. Providing humanitarian aid without considering the issue of religious persecution, understanding the nature of the atrocities, will never be able to address the atrocities and assist the targeted communities adequately. And we've heard also the case of the Daesh atrocities against religious minorities in Iraq and the assistance that was provided in response. But of course, the question is, what is happening in Nigeria? And Baroness Cox mentioned that, for example, in the UK, we do not consider the situation in Nigeria as having this religious or belief element. So we don't consider it as a case of religious persecution. In the case of Nigeria, in the UK, we are talking about climate change or land grab. And of course, if this is the narrative, of course, the response will never be adequate and will never address the issue adequately or at all. And I think the panelists today made a very clear case that religious persecution drives the need for humanitarian aid. That's very clear. But also religious persecution requires a tailored approach. And the assistance provided to the targeted communities must address the nature of the atrocities. And again, that's the religious persecution element of the atrocities. But one of the big problems that I see is that many countries do not monitor such situations and don't monitor the situation, for example, in Nigeria. And for us to be able to address religious persecution and provide the communities with adequate assistance, we need comprehensive mechanisms that will enable us to monitor the situation, determine the nature of the atrocities, and then inform the response, including humanitarian assistance. But unfortunately, this is not happening. And this is something that, for example, here in the UK, Lord Alton and Baroness Cox have been advocating for a very long time. So if we if we can do anything, and I think that should be the first step, would be to ensure that we have comprehensive mechanisms that can monitor the situation, determine the atrocities, and identify the response that is required in all those different cases. And for example, in the case of Nigeria, we are currently working on a new initiative, which is for the UN to establish a mechanism to monitor the atrocities in Nigeria, and then to identify the different elements of the atrocities, determine the nature of the atrocities, and hopefully end with the narrative that the atrocities are because of climate change or because of the land grabs, and hopefully will identify also the religious element of the atrocities, and then identify actions that need to be taken to address them. So thank you very much for your important contributions today and for your important work. And hopefully the approaches that, for example, the US and Hungary are already implementing, the approach to integrate humanitarian assistance and freedom of religion belief will be adopted by other countries, because it's definitely very much needed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Evelina. And I want to just commend all the speakers. You've done so well in keeping time, and we're basically right on time. So I appreciate all the speakers and the comments, and keeping the clock in mind as you presented. I will pose a few questions here, at least one which popped up in the Q&A. I believe we can pose, it was directed towards Bishop Kuka. And in summary, the question was, what more can the Christians in the southern part of Nigeria do in terms of aiding the crisis happening in the Middle Belt and in the northeastern part of Nigeria?
Sorry, thank you very much. I think Julia's question is a fantastic question, very relevant question. And it is something that I have agonized over. More people in Europe understand, have empathy, and are showing greater solidarity for the situation in the Christian community in northern Nigeria than our southern brethren. It is one of the very, very major issues that we need to address. It is happening too slowly. A good number of our southern brethren who are with us in northern Nigeria think that the problem is too distant. People are also concerned with economic pursuit and political transactions. And that is a very, very valid question. Unfortunately, very difficult to answer. But it's something that we are working on, because we need to get that together in order to be able to hold our ground much more firmly. But definitely it's a very important and relevant question.
Thank you, Bishop Kuka. I will pose one more, and this is more towards the government entities in the meeting, Tristan and Samah. And I believe that NGOs can also answer this. And the question is, how far do government and public authorities agree and accept educational programs working in promoting differences, dialogue, diversity, and peace in Nigeria and elsewhere?
I can just jump in, Matthias, if I may.
Please.
So prior to assuming my new role, I worked for 2.5 years overseeing the Religious Freedom Portfolio in the Middle East Bureau at USAID. And throughout my travel and engagement with local organizations in Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, most of faith-based leaders talked about the importance of education, that education, particularly in a place like the Middle East, a region like the Middle East, where coexistence is a historical, you know, communities without that mosaic and structure of Christians, Jews, and Muslims living together in the Middle East. There's no Middle East. There's absolutely no Middle East. But most of those local groups talked about the importance of education, the new generation, and the need for USAID to focus a lot besides the economic development, economic assistance and health, other sectors, that education was one of the top priorities to bring generation to understand about coexistence, And that's one of our focuses. USAID has six pillars that puts its work, as Alina articulated, the integration of humanitarian assistance with religious freedom. In economic, in health and economics, in persecution, in heritage preservation. But education is one of those pillars that we look seriously. Looking at the new generation, education plays an incredible role to overcome any of those differences. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Sama. I will pose one more question here, coming from Adi Alfing, and I apologize for mispronouncing that word, that name. But as a journalist who has been covering persecuted Christians since 2014, I'm curious to know how you protect the mental health of humanitarian workers and keep them strengthened to continue to do their work. I imagine that journalists are in the same shoe and in the same position as well, as they're dealing with traumas of the victims and their own traumas, providing support to tell their stories. I will pose that to the entire panel here if anybody wants to take that on.
Matthias, I can speak to that to some degree. Years ago, we set up a program for ministry care for our own staff. And we had teams that go to our various field sites, offices around the globe to help, to sit with people, to talk with people and work with people. So we try to be proactive in that area. And I think the question's a good one in that sense. And I think each organization that works in incredible areas of trauma has to address that, because you just never know how someone's going to react to what's seen from fighting 15 kilometers from ISIS fighting. And so those are very important issues.
Yeah.
And I just add a quick word. And that is, early this year, we visited Abyei between Sudan and South Sudan and witnessed a massacre of horrendous proportions. One of our colleagues in the staff team, we didn't realize we were going to see this, but she obviously had post-traumatic stress afterwards. So we actually have a policy whereby when people do witness things which are going to cause stress, there is a provision for post-traumatic stress counseling, which I think is crucial, because the kind of things we witnessed last week in Abyei, are shocking, terrifying, and they leave you with nightmares. And we do need some provision, especially for junior colleagues.
Matthias, just if you allow me, part of the Frank Wolf Act is the requirement for many of the Foreign Service officers to take training on advancing religious freedom. And that has been now a requirement and mandated by both the State Department and USAID for our Foreign Service officers that go on in the field to deal with some of those challenges. But as a person who works in Washington, I cannot imagine the trauma and the possible challenges and danger that many of those fellow USAID, whether Foreign Service officers or contractors that do on behalf of our country. So a lot of challenges, and we keep working on it. Over.
Very good. Thank you. Samaya, your earlier comments even kind of spoke to the religious literacy that comes through education in a lot of these communities. I just wanted to make that comment. I think that's a valuable piece that needs to be emphasized even more, creating that sense of pluralism and so on, and understanding of each other. Very much needed in this nexus that we've been discussing today. We can conclude the program here. We are at time, and I just want to send a note of thanks to all of our speakers. Excellent presentations. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Thank you for answering some of these questions that were posed, and thank you for the incredible work that you're doing. And most of all, I want to thank all our audience members who took time to join us today. We know the ministerial is going, and I know many of you will probably be attending that as well.
possibly even speaking there. And we just wish you all the luck. And we thank you so much for being with us today. So God bless you all. We will conclude there. Thank you.